Hi, everyone. This is Brian Holtzclaw. We're so happy to have you aboard. We've got 150 people enlisted. Half of you are simulcast, and you can submit questions. The other half, which are on the telephone line, we hope that you have downloaded and printed out the presentation and follow us along. For those on simulcast, if you do have any problems, I'm going to give you the phone number to report your problem and get it worked out behind the scenes. That phone number is 301-589-5318. I'm giving that because in the past, sometimes we've had a few callers with issues. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the call. This is Mike Norman. I'm the Brownfields Coordinator here in Region 4. And our goal today is to give you a lot of basic information about our Brownfields grant opportunities and to share tips and tricks that might give you an edge in a very competitive process here. So we've got a lot of items on the agenda. What we'll try to do, just to keep you in line with where we are on the presentation, is that periodically we'll mention to you what slide that you should be on if you're not on the simulcast and are just viewing this PowerPoint from your desktop or whatnot. But the speakers today, as Matt mentioned, I'll start out giving some introductory remarks, and then Olga Perry will follow, and followed by her will be Nicole Bates and then Brian Holtzclaw. What we're trying to do today is trying to go through this slide presentation, complete it by about 2:30, to allow about 25 minutes for questions and answers. There will be a lot of questions that require a very detailed description, and we will be preparing written responses for those. For those that we can answer quickly, we'll give the answer on the call today, but again, we'll follow up with a written response that you'll be able to access later. So with that, we're going to move on to slide number 3 and talk about what we're going to cover today. As I mentioned, we'll start out with a Brownfields overview, talking about some of the grant types here and the amounts that are available. We'll talk about the threshold criteria for applying for the grants, and we'll have an overview of the ranking criteria and provide some tips and tricks on the ranking criteria to help you prepare some successful applications here. So we'll move on to the Brownfields mission here. We're at our heart an assessment and cleanup program. As we address these contaminated properties, they can be returned to successful reuse. We provide grants and technical assistance for assessments and cleanups. We also provide job training grants. That process is open now. That's a separate competition that closes on October 15th. Is that right? 14th. So, but today we'll be talking about the assessment, revolving loan fund, and cleanup grants. As Matt mentioned, we're going to start out talking about assessment grants. We'll end that session at 2:55 today. We'll have a session beginning at 3:00 to discuss cleanup grants. If you're interested in only cleanup grants, I do encourage you to at least listen in on the first 17 slides or so here. We're going to that's the overview, and we may be able to go through that part more quickly on the cleanup session. Moving on to slide number 6, our Brownfields definition, and I'll read it here. It's real property, the expansion, redevelopment, or reuse of which may be complicated by the presence or potential presence of hazardous substances, pollutants, contaminants, controlled substances, petroleum or petroleum products, or is mined scarred land. One of the most important parts of that definition is the phrase potential presence of contaminants. And I say that because about 30% of the properties that we assess do not have contamination that requires cleanup. It's merely the perception that there may be expenses involved in cleaning up properties that often keep these properties from being redeveloped. So next slide. That definition talks about hazardous substances, contaminants, and just what all do they include? Well, hazardous substances is a regulatory term. The Superfund law includes a listing of hazardous substances. Petroleum contamination includes a variety of substances from crude oil through the refined products such as gasoline and diesel fuel. And asbestos and lead paint are eligible. They're hazardous substances. Controlled substances such as meth labs may be eligible for assessment cleanup grants under this opportunity. Mine scarred lands as well and a variety of other environmental contaminants fall under the pollutant or contaminant phrase. So some of the benefits of brownfields revitalization, the EPA's mission in all of its media programs is to protect human health and the environment. And brownfields is really no different. But in doing that, in protecting human health and the environment on these types of sites, we realize that there are a lot of other benefits that occur. Through redevelopment of these properties, the local tax base is increased. Jobs are created. You're able to utilize the existing infrastructure rather than going out in suburbia and destroying green space. In fact, a study has shown that for every acre of brownfields that's redeveloped, it preserves 4 acres of green space. We're able to bring that real estate back into productive use, prevent sprawl, promote cleaner air, and so there are just a number of benefits and a number of reasons why this is such a great program. Next slide. Some of the elements of brownfields revitalization in this process is that you start out with a vision and you identify the sites in your area that are problematic, that are creating blight. Through prioritization of those sites and assessment, getting some investment and cleanup, you're able to return those properties to productive use. For the assessment grants, we're going to talk about the first few parts of that. The identification, the development of inventories, and the assessment are all eligible activities, as is cleanup planning under the assessment grants. Next slide. Our program has been in existence. It started out as a pilot program in the 94 and 95 time frame. In that time, to date, we've awarded nearly 2,000 brownfields grants for almost $100 million. And this, in turn, has had a multiplying effect on the benefits. We've assessed nearly 12,000 properties. At $600 million invested, has leveraged more than $11 billion, with a B, in cleanup and redevelopment funding from the private and public sectors and generated nearly 50,000 jobs. On the next slide, which is slide 11, you see one example of a grantee success story, Five Mile Creek in the Birmingham, Alabama area. They're a winner this past year of the Phoenix Award, which is given for achievement in redevelopment of contaminated properties. On to the next slide. Our program, the overall brownfields program, consists of two major parts. The funding that we're talking about here goes toward grants and other technical assistance that we can provide. We're authorized for in the law, in the statute, for up to $200 million for funding for assessment grants, cleanup grants, revolving loan fund grants, and targeted brownfields assessments. Typically, the appropriation is more on the order of $90 million a year there. An additional $50 million is given to support the state response programs, and it's a very important component of this process because when you're doing assessments and cleanup grants in particular, you will be working with the state programs to meet the state requirements. So on to the next slide. We talk about this. We have the acronym, the Assessment Revolving Loan Fund and Cleanup Grants. We call them, typically refer to them as the ARC grants. We may use some other terminology, but if we use the term ARC grants today, that's basically what we're talking about here. Next slide. I just want to mention to you that this is a very competitive process. Really about one in three who apply will be successful, so there's a lot greater demand for these grants than there is available funding. And it's important that you take the time, and hopefully you've taken a lot of time before today, to put together a vision, demonstrate the need in your community, seek involved partners to put together a story, because ultimately that's what's going to sell these grants. That's what's going to make your proposal more competitive. For assessment coalitions, for example, it's something new that we're talking about this year, we're offering. I think it's going to be important to have a common thread in your proposals. For example, you might form a coalition of multiple municipalities that are suffering from textile mill closures, or you might have a coalition of a number of towns that share a river that have a goal of addressing contaminant sources along that river and restoring the green space along the riverfront. So those are, it's very important, very competitive, very important that you put together a good story to sell this, sell your proposal. In 2008, we received 845 proposals nationally. 314 of those were selected for funding for $74 million. And the breakdown was roughly two-thirds assessment grants, a third cleanup grants, and then a small handful, 12 revolving loan fund grants. In this region, we had 104 proposals. 50 of those were selected for funding for $11.4 million, and we're especially proud of the 48% success rate of our proposers from Region 4. So the time frame, and this is slide number 16 for this year, is that the guidelines became available on August 22nd, and the proposals, as most of you know, are due on November 14th of this year. We will begin review immediately after the 14th, and in the mid-April to mid-May time frame, we expect to make an announcement of these awards. And from the announcement date to the end of June, we'll be working with those of you who do get selected for funding to get in your grant paperwork and award those grants, hopefully have those awards and those funds available to you on July 1st of 2009. All right, next slide. So in terms of getting started, here are some web addresses of where these proposal guidelines are. And if you've done this before, you know that we had a single volume that contained the guidelines for all three grant types. This year, They're separate, and hopefully that makes them easier to understand. And but the important thing is that we're going to give you a lot of information here, but do read the proposal guidelines, look at the checklist, use them. There are things in there that we're not going to tell you today just due to the time limitations, and so it's very important to read and follow the guidelines very closely. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Olga Perry about the assessment grant program.
Good afternoon, everyone. Again, I'm Olga Perry, and I'm going to be discussing slides 18 through 28. Brownfield assessment grants provide an inventory, provide funds, I'm sorry, to inventory, characterize, assess, and conduct planning. This includes cleanup planning and community involvement related to brownfield sites. Again, remember, this particular grant is a three-year grant. Slide number 19. Assessment grants can help assess plating shops, salvage yards, dry cleaners, illegal drug labs, such as your meth labs. However, the examples that I've given you are on a case-by-case scenario. Particularly if you look at landfills, if you would need to pass thresholds in order for your site to be eligible. For petroleum sites, I know that some of you may have eyesores such as that gas station on the corner or in the middle of the community. You may have a fuel terminal or a former railroad switching and track area. These assessment funds can be used to assess those types of properties. Slide 21 provides a comparison, or at least a visual comparison, between community-wide versus site-specific assessment. With community-wide, as you see, you can cover a vast amount of land or a vast amount of property versus the single site-specific. However, with the site-specific grant, you can get up to $350K. However, you are limited to one specific site. If for some reason that property owner changes their mind in terms of allowing you on their property, you are stuck with that property. You cannot transfer funds. Whatever may happen, if you submitted a site-specific proposal, you are stuck with that property. However, with community-wide grants, you have the option to study a designated area, not just a specific piece of property. Slide 22. This year, as you see with this slide, this year the community-wide grants can cover hazardous substances as well as petroleum substances under one proposal. I hear you cheering out there. And you can get up to $400K to do that with. Next slide. Under site-specific grants, you can receive up to $300K, again, if you get a waiver for a large piece of property and you need it. However, again, you are limited to that one particular site and cannot transfer funds. That site also must pass the threshold criteria. If it doesn't pass the threshold criteria, you will be sent a letter saying, try again next year. Slide 24, that's one of our little placeholders. And it also shows you some assessment properties that are eligible for the assessment grant. 25, you heard Mike speak of the assessment coalition or assessment coalitions. More detail will be given later in the presentation on coalitions. However, this slide simply shows the basics of assessment coalitions. We envision small partners getting together with larger experienced members to assess desired reusable properties. And remember, again, let me go over the slide. It does say that you can, three or more eligible entities, you must be an eligible entity. You must assess up to five pieces of property or five sites. And coalition members are not eligible to apply for a separate community-wide or site-specific assessment grant. Slide 26. This slide is a summary of the options available. applicants that exceed the maximum number of proposals allowable for assessment grants will be contacted prior to review of any of the proposals by EPA. This will be to determine which proposals you would like for us to review. Let me add, the assessment grant, again, is 3 years in time period. Slide number 27 is a successful story for Region 4 out of Jackson, Mississippi. It was once a dry cleaner, and now it is a local police station. Slide number 28 provides information or website information regarding the job training grant as well as the targeted brownfield assessment grant. If you are interested in either of these grants, please know that job training grants are due October 14th. Please visit the website for contact information and details regarding the job training grant. As for targeted brownfield assessment program, this program is a year-round program. There is no deadline for TBAs, and again, please visit that website for additional details. Next.
Hello again, everyone. I'm Nicole Bates, and we will begin on slide 29. In the next section, we will discuss the threshold requirements for the assessment proposals. Slide 30. Threshold criteria are initial statements you must address before EPA can determine if you are eligible to receive brownfield funding. We developed the threshold criteria to increase the likelihood of your success in the brownfields program. Historically, the largest percentage of the proposals that we received wide. So the threshold criteria will be relatively simple for those who choose to complete those. The criteria are more complex for site-specific applicants. However, your Region 4 project officers can help by clarifying any questions you may have about the threshold criteria. The criteria that you will address will be reviewed by our Region 4 team, and there are two criteria for community-wide applicants and three for site-specific applicants. After our team reviews these, we will either mark your response pass or fail. Your proposals must pass each of these before EPA will evaluate your responses to the ranking criteria that we will discuss later. Now, if you fail any of these questions, your proposal will not compete in the national competition. So we ask that you are as thorough as you possibly can be with your responses. Slide 31. For community-wide applicants, the two criteria you will address are applicant eligibility and the letter to your state or tribal environmental authority. Site-specific applicants will address applicant eligibility, the letter to your state or tribal authority, and site property ownership eligibility. The next 11 slides explain these criteria in more detail. Let's begin with slide 32. The first threshold criterion, applicant eligibility, must be addressed by all applicants. You must describe how you are an eligible entity to receive assessment funding. Eligible assessment entities include general purpose units of local government, states and tribes, and quasi-governmental entities that operate under the supervision and control of a general purpose unit of local government. And these include regional councils of government, redevelopment authorities, and economic development agencies. Slide 33. This year, EPA is encouraging coalition applicants to apply for assessment funding. If you have at least three eligible entities that are interested in forming a coalition, then you are welcome to submit one combined community-wide proposal. Each coalition member must document how they are an eligible entity, You must each submit a letter to your lead coalition member who will serve as the assessment proposal applicant. And each of those letters must be attached to your proposal. We realize the level of funding available to the coalitions is extremely attractive, but before considering this, we encourage you to have a clear plan detailing how you will use these dollars. Because we have seen grantees in the past who've requested large amounts of funding, unfortunately, we've also seen that they were unable to spend all of that money, and at the end of their project periods, they had to return the funds to EPA. So please avoid that again by encourage you to have a clear and detailed plan for your coalition. The second threshold criteria is detailed on slide 34. For this requirement, you must attach a recently dated letter for 2008 from your state or tribal environmental authority. The letter must acknowledge that you plan to conduct or oversee the assessment and or the cleanup activities and acknowledge that you are applying for grant funds. You may copy the same letter if you plan to also apply for cleanup or revolving loan fund grants as well. But you must submit a copy of that letter with each proposal. If you've not already asked for this letter from your state or your tribal authority, then please request it now. These entities will create several of these letters for other applicants, so the sooner you request yours, the better. Slide 35. If you only have one site to assess, then you will submit a site-specific proposal. If you do so, then you must address the site and property ownership eligibility criterion. If you are applying for community or area-wide assessments, then you do not need to address these questions in your proposal. The Brownfields Law prohibits EPA from granting funds to those liable for contamination. And we determine whether or not this is the case for your sites based on how and when the site was acquired. Slide 36. Sites that are not eligible for Brownfields funding include those that are listed or proposed for listing on the National Priorities List, those subject to unilateral administrative orders on consent or judicial consent, or those sites that are subject to control by the United States government. Slide 37. For those sites contaminated with hazardous substances, EPA will review the information you provide for this criterion to determine if the site is eligible. If you are liable for the contamination according to CERCLA or the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation and Liability Act, then the site will not be eligible. For petroleum-contaminated sites, your state environmental agency will determine if the site is eligible. If you are submitting a petroleum proposal for one site, then you must respond to the questions on pages 16 and 17 of the Assessment Proposal Guidelines, and then provide these responses to your state agency before November 14, 2008. State will then send a petroleum determination letter back to you. Now, this is different from the state's acknowledgement letter that I mentioned a few moments ago. So you must attach the state's petroleum determination to your proposal as well. Slide 38. Now, we've just discussed site eligibility for site-specific proposals. Now, let's briefly talk about ownership eligibility. The owner of the site or property is liable for contamination on that site unless the following exemptions apply. If they've acquired the property involuntarily, if they are a bona fide prospective purchaser, an innocent landowner, or a contiguous property owner. If any of those exemptions apply, then the site is eligible. Slide 39. This slide discusses the ownership eligibility issue in more detail. If you are planning to submit a site-specific proposal, then review the information detailed on slides 39 and 40. Here, we list the common exemptions and defense claims to determine if any of these scenarios apply to you. If you need any clarification on any of these, then please contact one of the EPA Region 4 project officers with any questions you may have. Slide 39 lists common acquisition scenarios. Let's move on to slide 40. This details the bona fide prospective purchase defense. And slide 41. Here we discuss the site-specific applicants, and here you must ensure that they conduct an all-appropriate inquiry on any given property before you take ownership of that property. You can determine which standard applies to you depending on when you acquired that property. Slide 42. Earlier I mentioned that you must provide responses to the questions on pages 16 and 17 of your proposal guidelines. And your responses to these must be provided to your state agency if you only have one petroleum property to assess. The state will review those responses and then will give you a written determination that will detail if the site is low risk, if there's a viable responsible party. It will also determine if you are responsible for the contamination and whether or not a RCRA corrective action has been placed on that site. Enclose those responses that you see from your state agency in your proposal as well. That concludes the threshold criterion. We'll now move on to ranking with Brian.
Hello, everyone. I'm Brian Holtzclaw. Hopefully you've got enough of threshold information to last you a while. Again, community-wide assessments allow you to have a lot easier way to go about to that threshold response question. But if you really want site-specific, there's a lot more information involved. So the ranking criteria section is not just pass-fail. It's really getting the most points out of your proposal narrative as possible. And what we're going to do is go through the main criteria. There's four criteria overarching, and they are, next slide, slide 44, community need, project description and feasibility of success, community engagement and partnerships, and project benefits. This is different from other years. So if you've applied for grants in previous years, we have really modernized the way we go about these proposals. And we think and we hope we've made it easier for applicants. So again, each criteria is made up of sub-criteria. In total, there's four general criteria and 12 sub-criteria, and to score the highest score possible, really need you to answer each question as best as possible. There are different scoring for all the different kinds of grants, so just pay attention that they all add up to 100 points. So for the first criteria, what we're looking for is information on community needs. The first section is health, welfare, environment, and what we want here is for you to start off on a good foot to introduce the evaluator at EPA, which in this case will be three evaluators reading your application. And we really want to get a good grasp of the number and size of brownfields, as well as the respective health, welfare, and environmental impact of those respective sites in your targeted community. we want you to give us a good idea of mainly what your targeted community is. It's very clear that you spell that out initially in a lot of as much detail as possible, whether that be a jurisdictional boundary or a county, a city, a part of a city. We need to really talk about it and also describe the acreage and the typical kinds of brownfield sites there. We also want to hear about the sensitive populations in your respective community, such as minorities, children, and also women of childbearing age, elderly persons as well. Lastly, we want to have you communicate any disproportionate environmental health impact data. Quite often you can look at your local health agency and assess whether there has been any asthma, cancer studies, or blood level tests done in your area. The second part of community need is a financial need. And here we want you to describe particularly the adverse economic impacts of brownfields on your community. We want you to talk about the rates of poverty, household income, unemployment rate, and other kinds of demographic information. We highly encourage you to use a tabular format instead of a paragraph format. Any way you can make the evaluator read the information easier and simpler, this is very highly encouraged. If you have a company that was a manufacturing plant that was closed recently, we want you to talk about that with respect to the economic impact, tax revenue impact. We want you to paint a picture of the disadvantaged or how needy your community is with respect to this grant, because in the end, like Mike said, this is a grant which can help turn communities around financially. So we want to hear what's going on financially there. The next slide, 48, is a sample table. You don't necessarily have to use this format in particular, but that gives you a sample of the need to reference your targeted community against state and national data to provide the contrast of the potential adverse conditions in your community as far as statistics go. Before moving on to the next criteria, I'm going to tell you about a relatively new tool that Region 4 has created. It is on the CLUIN website. Instead of making this presentation much longer, as in years past, we used to put success tips within the PowerPoint slides. A tool called quote-unquote success tips. Set your CLUIN site for downloading under available resources. I'm just going to take two sample tips that we've compiled in there for each criteria. I'm going to just take it the community needs section. One of the things we do recommend is that you do not target residential areas and say that you're going to assess those properties. General targeted community can include those areas, of course, but we definitely need to paint a picture of what kinds of brownfields are present. And in that, we give examples of things you might want to look for, corner gas stations, junkyards, particularly with respect to community-wide, and mention them by name. If you don't know how many are there, we also recommend on that success tips tool, go ahead and do your own driving survey, research some old city directories, and perhaps also even contact your state brownfields coordinators. They may have a database that can tell you how many petroleum underground storage tanks there are with respect to being abandoned and so forth. The second tip, is we have information and access to the Region 4 U.S. Census Bureau, they should be very helpful to provide statistics. We list the phone number, the name, and the email address.
So I'm going to pass it on to Cole.
We're moving on to slide 49. Here we ask you to describe each of your project activities while illustrating a complete project plan. Now, this should include your past and planned inventory efforts, your site selection process and how the community will be involved with selecting your sites, as well as how you will prioritize these for assessment, and the approximate number of Phase 1 and possible Phase 2 assessments you will conduct. And don't forget to describe how you will address access issues with those private owners as well. Also include any local or state redevelopment incentives that are available in your area for your property owners. Demonstrate that you have the resources and that you are capable of achieving the goals of this proposed project within the 3-year grant period. And here are a few additional helpful hints for community-wide applicants. Allocate the bulk of your proposed funding to site assessment. And for your coalition applicants, you must assess a minimum of 5 sites. Refer to page 31 of your assessment proposal guidelines to get an idea of the brownfields programmatic requirements that EPA is going to expect you to achieve once you are awarded the grant. Let's move on to slide 50. We suggest you use a table format to display your budget. After the budget table, completely explain each of your programmatic tasks in narrative form. Provide measurable outputs, such as the number of Phase 1 and possible Phase 2 assessments you plan to conduct, and list the associated costs for those if possible. Typically, assessment grantees only extend costs for supplies, so explain and justify how you will use those in your project. Assessment applicants may use up to 10% of the grant funding to conduct health monitoring tasks, and these may include monitoring the health of populations and monitoring and enforcing the use of institutional controls. Choose to use your funding for health monitoring activities, project description, and list this activity in your budget. Also ensure that each of your expenses are for programmatic use only. Do not include any administrative costs. Slide 51. Here we give an example of a budget table that we have received in the past. Again, only list here programmatic expenses. Slide 52. If you determine that additional work may be required for your project, then describe the non-EPA public and private sources of funding you will seek to complete the additional work. Discuss how you plan to fill any funding gaps that EPA brownfields dollars will not address for your total project. And provide examples of any past leveraging efforts you have achieved. Slide 53. Here we discuss programmatic capability, and we would like you to demonstrate your ability to manage an assessment grant and your ability to oversee the work that you propose to accomplish. For prior brownfields grantees, illustrate your past grant management experience and document how well you performed on those brownfields grants. Include how much of that money you spent to date and how you complied with our terms and conditions, as well as the number of assessments or cleanups you completed. If you have any adverse audits, then please tell us about these. Full disclosure here is important.
If there were any corrective actions, then detail those as well. Slide 54. If you're not a prior Brownfield grantee, then please tell us how you plan to manage and perform on this particular Brownfield grant, and also list other grants of this size that you've managed before. Please let us know whether or not you plan to hire external contractors to help you with this grant, or if you plan to use resources from in-house. And we'd like you to detail the prior 3 years of your grant management experience. And this could be experience with federal grants, state or foundation grants. List any adverse findings that you have with those or any corrective actions that have taken place as a result. Now we'll move on to the community engagement portion of this discussion, slide 55.
Good afternoon again. This is Olga Perry. Again, as you've heard Brian say, that periodically you'll hear us refer to information that is not on the slide, and you can find those tips, and as Mike said, tricks attached on the clue-in session. Please do refer to them, because there are more of these tips than what we can tell you about as we go through these presentations. This afternoon, I will cover slides 55 through 63, community engagement and partnership. Under this criterion, proposals will be evaluated based on your plan for engaging the targeted community in the project to be funded under this grant, the extent to which you have identified and established a relationship with the partners necessary to achieve the project's goal, and the extent to which the support letters provided by the community-based organizations involved with this project demonstrates specific and valuable commitment to the project. Next slide, please. Slide 56. In addition to the written information, there are two tips addressing this criterion under community engagement. Highlight how the plan will involve the affected community, including groups such as neighborhood organizations, church-based, interested civic nonprofit or redevelopment groups, borrowers, citizens, groups, and redevelopers. Do not include non-key community-based organizations such as local governments, politicians, or elected officials. In your community involvement plan, remember that involvement is a two-way street. Believe me, as a ranking official here at EPA, if your proposal simply states that you're going to tell the people what you're doing, you will not score very high on your proposal. Remember that one component may be to ask for public comment or input to your project work plan, project progress, project plan, such as site selection process, or cleanup analysis, which requires public comment. Include how you may provide feedback or response to the public. Address all potential language barriers. This is very important. If you include in your geographic information that you have a non-English population there and you do not address that under this criterion, you will not score the maximum amount of points
necessary, because we will consider that you are slighting that community. Slide 57. Here, you will need to demonstrate your knowledge of local, state, tribal program, and so forth, that you will or have already partnered with. Also, describe applicable state programs and how you will collaborate with them for a successful brownfield result. For working with state brownfield / a VCP program, examples include coordination on environmental assessment reports, especially a phase two, pre and post cleanup completion, certification, technical assistance, etc. You are encouraged to indicate how you will work with your local health department if available. Especially important if you choose to use 10% of the overall assessment grant to conduct health monitoring activities. Outline how you will coordinate with the health department or other qualified organizations. Slide 58. This deals with community-based organizations. For rural areas with fewer formal, what the acronym CBOs, you may hear us refer to that, discuss the active involvement of community stakeholders who are interested in redeveloping the community, informal neighborhood groups, etc. Also, a letter from each CBO or community-based organization mentioned in the proposal should be attached and show and should also include the following: a description of specific project or roles that particular CBO will play. Also include a description of the CBO's commitment to the project and a recent date. Do not use recycled letters prior to 6 months from November 14th. And by all means, please do not include any form letters. If these are included, they will not help you to score the maximum amount you can receive. In the past, we have contacted these community-based organizations and verbally inquired of their involvement. We will no longer do that. This information will have to be included in the proposal as an attachment. Slide 59. Overall, this is project benefit. Overall, proposals will be evaluated on the extent to which your project anticipates outcomes. Consider mentioning specific contaminants of concerns for your community. Example, for community-wide proposals, it helps to share an idea for the types of sites and associated contaminants that are possibly present in your community. Also, explain how you plan to address those contaminants via assessment or cleanup work. Explain how nearby communities and their health will be protected during your assessment. For example, during assessment, ensure characterization emphasizes checking the boundary site conditions, especially if residential properties are adjacent. Ensure if contaminants of concern are indeed contained on the site or have migrated off-site. For example, efforts may be made to assess drainage ditches for contamination that may be carried waste off-site. Perhaps your inventory and site selection process will identify high-risk brownfields and the local government will consider erecting perimeter fences to protect children. Slide 60. This deals with welfare and or public health. Describe the environmental, social, and or public health benefits anticipated from the redevelopment of sites assessed and or cleaned up under this grant. Communicate all benefits, including direct and indirect from assessment, cleanup, and site reuses. Plan for community-sensitive populations. Be congruent with your community needs, with your community needs section. If you've discussed this information previously, how the project needs to mitigate certain human health, such as lead exposure, or social, such as crime, risk in the targeted area. Refer to local health assessment reports. Surely this information is out there, and by all means, try your local health department. Slide 61, economic benefits and or green space. Explain how the grant will produce economic and or non-economic benefits. Mention economic benefits such as expanded tax base, increased employment, job creation, increased investment, enhanced property values through adjacent green space creation and or neighborhood improvements and or others. As for non-economic benefits, consider mentioning that redevelopment of a targeted area can reduce development pressures on rural and undeveloped sites, known as green fields. Mention non-economic benefits such as green space, trails, parks, community gardens, or nonprofit community centers, etc., as possible. Slide number 62, economic benefits from infrastructure reuse, sustainable reuse. Describe how the assessment grant will help facilitate infrastructure reuse. Please, please, please be specific. Mention how your project applies to sustainable reuse, to smart growth benefits, and other examples. Be sure to refer to information that you can find on the additional websites that we have listed and information for websites that are listed in the tips and tricks, that is, guideline or attachment. Link any overarching master plans, development plans, zoning, and other planning tools that may be in place to address sustainable reuse, retaining green fields, stormwater runoff initiatives, etc. Sometimes proposals mentioned at the minimum fact sheets will be given to new owners or developers, reconstruction or post construction practices of water conservation, smart growth, energy efficient. Next is Nicole. They will cover slide, I'm sorry, I have 63?
Yes.
Okay. Project Overcome.
Outcome.
Ooh, okay. I have bifocals, and I'm looking up at a screen, and it's not giving me the information I need, so forgive me for this one. Project Outcome. Describe your plan for tracking and measuring your progress toward achieving the expected project goal. Outcomes need to be quantitative. Examples, number of sites assessed, number of sites cleaned up, of jobs created, number of cleanup dollars leveraged, number of redevelopment dollars, dollars leveraged via economic reuse of sites, and number of acres, green space, etc. Next, we will go to the reuse application preparation tip.
Hi, everybody. This is Brian again. We're on the home stretch here. We only got a few slides left before we start our question and answer session. Just going to talk about general good proposal preparation tips, again, at the Cluin site. There's many more of these at the Success Tips tool. The main thing we want you to do is tell your story. I think we formatted the guidelines in a way where we can help you, you know, tell your story. We need you to just fill in and just answer the guidelines amongst all those four criteria and just be as exactly thorough as possible. We do want, Olga implied, if you talk about a community need, and one of the things Brownfield is going to reduce is blight, go ahead, don't forget, Section 4, we want you to talk about that project benefit. But it has to be congruent. The next slide would be 66. Another advertising moment here. At that particular website, we have two tools. The first one we've already talked about. To reduce the clutter on the PowerPoint, we've broken out all the tools we've used in previous years, and it's on a Word document. You can use it while you're sitting down hammering out your grant proposal, which from some past recipients, it's taken 20 to 40 to 80 hours to write. And so that tool should be really invaluable. We put a host of ideas that should help you be thorough in case you're stuck on one of the criteria and don't know what to think about. The second bullet there talks about a section length tool. This is the second year we've employed this little mini calculator. As you'll see when you read the guidelines, different criteria and sub-criteria, we call them sections, have different weighting factors. For instance, community need, I think it may be an assessment. It's worth 20 points. And the two subsections are worth 10 points. What it does is basically, for those who don't know, the total maximum pages is 18. I'm about to get into that. But if you've occupied your proposal with one page of threshold criteria, which is often the community-wide one, it's much simpler, that would leave you 17 pages for the narrative. What the calculator simply does is you put one page threshold, it prints out 17 pages narrative, and it multiplies the 17 pages by the fractions that each section is worth. For instance, if you had a subcriteria worth 15%, it'd multiply that by 17 pages. It tell you a target number of pages you need to dedicate to that section. What we saw in several debriefing exercises over the years is people love to write about things they love to write about, yet they forget that certain sections are higher scoring sections. So this is a simple guide to help you allocate your pages accordingly to get the most points as possible. Next is 67. The new guidelines, you probably don't have the booklets as we do, but they are three different websites. They're at the Cluin website, and you can go to it easy that way, and it's within the presentation. If you were unsuccessful in years past and you asked for our advice, hopefully you still got those notes, please reflect back on them. We will give feedback if you miss out on any year of trying to get a proposal. We do highly encourage get mentoring from prior grantees. That website lists all the previous grantees. Most of them are very flattered if you call them and say you want to talk to them.
I'm sure some of them would be happy to share their past proposal. But keep in mind, this year we totally reformatted the proposal, and it would have some benefit, but please don't use it as a total go-by. The next bullet speaks of the fact that some of our 8 states within regions 4, the Brownfields office may have the time to assist you, maybe give you some feedback. Within each state also are regional planning districts, development districts, and some of them have very good grant writers on board, and you may want to call them and get some feedback also on your draft. And we do have a technical assistance of Brownfields Communities program that we fund. That website is and contact information is at the CLUIN resource page. That also does list the contacts for each of your states. And as we indicated earlier, you will need a state acknowledgement letter and perhaps even a petroleum letter. That attachment, I think it's called Region 4 Brownfields Contacts. It lists all the state contacts as well as this TAB program contacts. The next slide would be 68. We do want you to use the checklists. I don't know what page it is in the assessment guidelines, but it's a pretty good checklist before you send it in. And make sure you do write it accordingly, as though the reviewer, in fact, will not be from this southeast region. They may be from a post up in Alaska or up in Maine or Massachusetts that are Maine offices, and you really have to describe it thoroughly. Avoid, the checklist on page 29. Avoid acronyms and be sure you avoid acronyms or colloquialisms and phrases for things that you only know in your community. 69 talks about formatting, and you got to obey the 18-page limit. We saw a proposal that went up to 20 or 22 pages the other year, and it was from New Orleans, the time of Katrina, and we just had to only read the first 18 pages, so don't make a mistake like that. We do want you to use white space, but don't be too liberal on white space. There's a balance you have to achieve there. There's some other formatting issues there, one inch margin, 12 point. It's all in the guidelines. I won't belabor that point. And please limit your attachments. We don't want a whole lot of reports. The master plan or the vision things in years past, we've allowed that. We're going to restrict to minimal attachments this year, avoiding photos. The next one would be slide 70. Suggest that you do use bolding. Instead of when you're writing the grant, be sure you copy and paste the header for the subsections and the main sections, the criteria. So we follow along with you as the guidelines in the same flow and order as the guidelines. And yes, before mailing, please be sure you have all the pages. Please double check dates, etc. And the last slide here, proposal preps. We do want you to contact on threshold issues, eligibility if you're going after the site specific, which usually we don't have a whole lot of people, but we do want you to contact as well as the state and the tribes if that's applicable. Additional resources. What would that be, slide 73? Mike, you can call Mike or myself. The whole Brownfields team is at the CLUIN website. It's called EPA Brownfields Team. You can look at our names and phone numbers and call any of us. And keep in mind, we can't give you feedback on your draft proposal, but we can tell you some answer some questions about threshold criteria. On the next following slides is what's reiterated in the download at the Clue-In. It's all our state contacts, and these people work very hard to maintain and develop their Brownfields program. They are the key resource to you getting the absolutely mandatory state acknowledgement letter. It's a fairly simple letter. Be sure to give them ample time to produce that letter so you can attach it to your proposal. So that's about 3 pages of contacts, and at the end there is the tab contacts. They're explicitly contracted out by headquarters to provide some technical assistance, and depending on their workload, they can give you feedback on your draft proposal. And wrapping up here, there's a bunch of web resources. Some of them are at the Clue-In site. We have an FAQ, frequently asked questions posted. Look at the information on coalitions, a great fact sheet if you're going that route, as well as other websites. So I'm going to look to the team, and I think we're ready to get on to the next step here.
Okay, this is Mike Norman again. We'll start the question and answer period just with the ones that have been posted online to begin with, and then we'll open it up to those of you by phone to ask. There have been 4 questions submitted so far, and you can continue to submit questions, and we'll try to answer them as time permits. The first question is on slide number 18. I wanted to confirm that a Phase 1 environmental site assessment is required for a site-specific grant request. I did not see these in the guidelines. Could you please address this further? And the answer is that a Phase 1 is not required for a site-specific assessment grant request. There are requirements for cleanup grants, and we'll be going into those during the cleanup session, including some new requirements this year. The second is about the beeping when people sign in and out, and we apologize for that. That's just the nature of our phone system. When you do mute the phone or unmute the phone, the beeping does occur. So hopefully if you keep that to a minimum, it'll eliminate some of the disruption. But, again, it's just the nature of the system that we have here. The next one's an interesting question. What's the required length of this document and how much does it have to weigh? And the answer is 26.7 pounds. I'm just kidding there. But it is an 18-page requirement, as Brian mentioned during his part. And you also, that's the length that is allowed for addressing the threshold and rank criteria. In addition to that, you should include letters from your community-based organizations that are supporting you, as well as the 2-page cover letter, the letter from the state, the acknowledgement letter, and if applicable, the petroleum determination letter. Use the checklist within the guidelines just to make sure that you do meet all the submission requirements. The next question is, if you are filing a community-wide assessment grant, combined hazardous and petroleum, are you required to get a petroleum letter, the petroleum determination letter from the state? And the answer is no, you're not required for community-wide. We will be, if you're selected as sites are identified, once you've got the grant awarded, we'll be determining eligibility for those sites. But the petroleum determination letter is only required for site-specific assessment grants. Okay, next question is Brian. How many letters of support should or can I have? Do you have a maximum and a minimum?
This is the first year we formally required this, and there is no maximum or minimum. As our team indicated, we only want them from community-based organizations. Not government elected officials or planning agencies, more of the grassroots, neighborhood, faith-based organizations. If you're a rural community, you know, it may be a really tough thing, those, you know, letters, number of letters in. Urban may be a lot easier, but I wouldn't say if you give us 50 letters, we want you to focus on the main partners that you're going to be collaborating with. This is not a contest, and we're not going to give you, you know, a grant if you collected 200 letters from citizens. So keep in a reasonable number, and we really only want the true partners who are going to be at the table to help guide the decision-making and be a true partner in this.
Okay, and I'll just add to that, as Brian alluded to, more is not necessarily better. It's really the quality and content that we're looking for, making sure that they are indeed partners of yours. In the past, when this was not so much a requirement, we often got a lot of form letters from different organizations with different letterhead. We strongly discourage that now. We want to see individual tailored letters from the individual organizations indicating their commitment to the project, the resources that they bring to the project, and the success or the aid towards success that they might be able to bring.
And certainly their role. What role do you see themselves playing in this proposal, in the grant process? That's what we need to know the most. The number is simply limited to the amount of organizations you have.
Okay. I think let's answer one more online and then open it up to the next.
Okay, the next one from the simulcast viewers, and then we'll switch to the ones on the phone line. The question is, did you say that you would not review draft proposals? That's correct. Due to our competition advocate, way back when we used to, you know, comment on draft proposals, our hands are tied with that respect. Ever since formally the Brownfields Law came into effect in 2002. So we really encourage you to partner and get mentoring from historical grantees, and that website was offered earlier. Grant writers within your community or regional area, such as regional planning councils, or maybe your find the grant writer within your local government, within that agency, and if there's a partnering agency that has a good grant writer, you know, you just, the more edits you have on a proposal, truly the better. And if you can get some old ones as a go-by to get some ideas, but remember the reformatting is completely different this year, we would advocate that. All right, we're going to take some online questions. Mike, you want to facilitate that?
Hey, do we have any questions from the audience by phone?
Yes, my name is Winetta Wright, and I'm with the Eastside Environmental Council, and this is my first time participating, and I'd like to also acknowledge I appreciate the information that you all have given. This will be my first time, and when you speak about the cover letters, do we get to put in a brief summary as far as our mission or vision statement on there? Is that required? And also, if I'm using someone in my local government, I know you made it clear about the local government letters, but will we need to get put the information of that person with the local government information on there too?
Yeah, the transmittal letter, the requirements for that are actually explained on page 20 of the guidelines. It talks about identifying the applicant, who you are, and and a contact for the organization. Again, there's a two-page limit on that. You talk about what type of grant you're applying for, how much the funding you're applying for, whether it's hazardous substances, petroleum contamination, or both, and a breakdown if you're applying for both, whether or not it's a community-wide, a site-specific, or an assessment coalition, what your organization is, and if it is a site-specific proposal, you provide the name of the property, address, and zip code, and whatnot. So, again, that's on page 20. You do talk about the contacts, the project director, who the highest-ranking elected official is in your organization, date it, the project period, population, and then you go into your narrative proposal after that. But, again, the cover letter requirements are fairly specific. It's called the transmittal letter in the guidelines.
Okay, so if I'm going to do the petroleum and I get a local official and I also have health issues, I can use the both health department and that local official information, right?
So you're saying the health department would be the project director in this case? And
yes.
Okay, yeah, so you can provide that name, and then as well the if it's county, a county commission chairman, if it's a city, it would be a mayor.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question.
Yes.
My name is David Ilonia. I'm with Tampa Housing Authority. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're a little muffled.
Okay. My name is David Ilonia with Tampa Housing Authority.
That's better.
I have a question. Upon listening to the presentation, I know that there's more emphasis on the letters from the community in informing them of or them being partners with the application. Is that heavily, the decision to award, is that heavily weighed on that or on the extent of contamination? In other words, if I'm dealing with a site that is heavily contaminated and it's a huge impact to the surrounding neighborhood or to the community, definitely this site has to be cleaned up. But again, for some reason, the community or the partners, I wasn't able to fully substantiate or get a support from the community. Is that going to impact on the award, or even though the site is still contaminated for health reasons?
Those are actually separate ranking criteria, and how you deal with the site, plan to deal with the site, assuming this is site-specific, and how you're going to address the contamination, that's addressed in really mostly in the project description section, which is, I guess, a total of basically 5 points for the project description, and then the budget is sort of reflected there for 10 points. So your community engagement is a total of 20 points there. You can possibly be weaker in some areas and stronger in others. I mean, each proposal is going to be evaluated on its own merits, and a bottom line score is going to be developed. The problem I see is that this is such a competitive process that it's going to be those that are strong throughout. They've got strong needs that need to be addressed. They've got serious problems of contamination, of jobless situations. They've got situations where there are, exposures to children and whatnot, and they have a clear plan, a clear vision. They have put together a network of people in that community. They've been working with them for some time to develop process and to develop the vision, and it's a clear community vision. So those are going to be the strongest ones, and I think you do the best you can to address the criteria. We often tell people, with respect to community organizations, you need to start the planning several months in advance for this, long before the guidelines are even published, to be able to put together, the kind of proposal that needs to be put forth to be a winner. Other questions? All right, we'll go to the next question online, and we still have 20 minutes or so. How far in advance should I ask my state for a letter? And this is, I assume, the acknowledgement letter. Actually, if you're applying site specifically, you would also have to ask for a determination letter. We encourage you to ask the state as soon as possible for both. The petroleum determination letter obviously takes a lot more time, and give the state a lot of advance notice. I know a lot of our states like to tailor the acknowledgement letters. They like to know a little bit more about the project, and so now is present. No time better than the present to go ahead and ask the state for that letter. The next question is a three-part question. Are there past winning proposals online we can look at, possibly Five Mile Creek Greenway proposal? And actually, we don't have those online. In the archives, in the site archives, if you go to epa.gov/brownfields under site archives, you can go in and look at some of the past winners of grants and fact sheets, and they provide contact information. You can request proposals from some of those who have won in the past, and I encourage you to look at them and borrow some of the good parts. But again, make that proposal, the proposal you put together, your own proposal, tailor it to your community. Second part is, under a community-wide grant, do the properties have to be contiguous? And the answer is no, they don't. And
explain what contiguous is for some.
Yeah, contiguous means, I'm assuming you're thinking they abut one another, they're adjacent to one another, and no, you can address if your community is old town, you might address the property on the west side, the east side, and the south side. The third part is better explain health monitoring tasks, please. Slide number 50.
Can I ask one more question before we go to the email questions? I'm sorry, this is Ms. Wright again, whenever Wright.
Can I just finish answering?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. The health monitoring, I just want to mention that it's for the local governments only, and that 10% of the funds can be used for health monitoring. And on that slide, we really don't want to address.
I can add something, and then Margaret's. On the attached, in the Cluin resource page, there is the frequently asked questions, and question number 76 speaks more to that. In addition, on page 5 of the success tips tool, we do talk more about that, and we also give a website. A certain document has been produced on speaking to monitoring health on these kinds of grants, so refer to page 5 on that success tips tool.
Margaret, did you want to say anything?
I think that that brochure is excellent, and it gives you a good basis to address the scopes of health monitoring, and then you could call one of us on the team. You could either call myself, Margaret Crow, or one of the people listed on the teams if you wanted to go into that.
Again, that 10% health monitoring activity is entirely optional.
Okay, we had a question, a follow-up question from the audience.
Yes, I wanted to ask. I'm already dealing with a contaminated site, and we're in talks with it. Can I utilize that project that I'm working on for this proposal? And it's also in regards to a contaminated creek that is not being addressed. So would it be, since this is something I've already been dealing with for a long time, can I include that, or can I use that project that I've been working on for several years in order to apply for this grant?
What we're talking about are assessment grants. Are those the kind of needs that you need to have addressed?
Mm-hmm. Okay, yes.
Additional site assessment, site characterization, cleanup planning, whatnot.
Okay. Right.
Those are some of the tasks that these are eligible for. So if those are some of the needs that you have, certainly that's what this grant could be used for. Now, this is for costs going forward, though. I mean, we're not
right.
addressing any costs that might have been incurred in the past.
Okay.
Okay. Additional questions by phone? All right, we'll move forward. We got about 14 more minutes here. And the next question is, when writing for an assessment coalition grant, as we understand it, most of the grant is written around the lead recipient's organizational capacity and experience. Is this correct? And, especially for the programmatic capability, you're going to talk about that lead grant recipient's ability to manage the grant, and that's a 20-point criteria there. We understand, as an additional part of that question, we understand the need to show the common thread through all of the coalition members relative to need. Can you speak more to this topic? And, I threw out a couple of examples when I gave my introductory remarks. And, this is a new topic, and I really don't know exactly what to expect here, but just as a tip, I think that in general, these good stories, these found stories, these demonstrations of need, and these clear visions of addressing those needs are what really have an impact on the reviewers. And I think that if you have a number of different communities with a number of different problems, that may read like a disjointed proposal. On the other hand, if you have a proposal, and the example I use, one of the examples I used was where you have a number of communities with abandoned textile mills and lost jobs and blight created by that, I think that is a common thread that would bind those communities together. Another might be a situation where you've got a contaminated stream and you have contaminant sources along that stream, and you have a desire to clean them up and create a greenway. That, to me, is another example of a thread that runs through the communities that are part of that coalition. And there are probably many others, but I think the bottom line here is I think it's important to build a good, strong story and demonstrate a need and have a vision to sell whatever you're trying to sell, your coalition, your community, your site. Next question. We are looking to purchase two adjacent parcels to add to a historic site that is adjacent to them.
Is this a community-wide or site-specific application?
I would say that would probably best be dealt with as a community-wide. In fact, I would encourage community-wide applications as a rule of thumb. If, for example, you don't gain access to one or both of those properties, you're not going to be able to switch out and use the grant funds elsewhere in your community. If, for example, the assessment doesn't cost the maximum amount of your grant funds, you would still have funds available to use elsewhere in your community. So there are a number of reasons why I would encourage you to apply for that situation as a community-wide assessment grant. The next question is, a statistic was quoted early in the presentation regarding the greenfield savings of brownfields redevelopment. And that was mine. 1 acre of brownfield saved, 4 acres of greenfield saved. Is there a source for this? And I've heard it so many times for several years that I don't know the source. I'll try to look that up, and if I can find it, we'll post it as part of the answer to these questions. But I'm sorry, I don't have a specific answer on that. The next question is, if you are doing a community-wide assessment, how do you handle something you think is a Superfund site? Where do you go to find out if this is a Superfund site? There's a couple of pieces to answering that question. One, if it's a Superfund site, if it's a National Priorities List site, for example, it's not eligible for funding. If it's a site that is subject to a unilateral administrative order, consent order, judicial consent decree, or whatnot, it's also not eligible. If it's subject to a removal action under Superfund, it can be what we call an add-back. It's a site that requires a site-specific determination. If through the use of these funds, if promote economic redevelopment or green space creation. So, there's some site-specific issues to deal with on that one. Again, if you're doing a community-wide, and that's the first part of your question there, if that site is determined to be ineligible for some reason, you would be able to use the funds on other sites in that community. Again, this is a threshold issue, and we can give some advice on threshold issues. It's the review of proposals and the ranking criteria that we can't provide advice on now that we're in the competition period. Let me go back out one more time to the audience by phone just to see if there's some other questions.
I have one more question. My name is Ms. Wright. If you're using a specific site, and say, for instance, a gas station, is there a minimum, a maximum amount of jobs that you have to create? Say, for instance, if you did get the proposal and you got the site, is there a minimum, a maximum? Because, like, maybe if I do a gas station, it might employ maybe 5 or 6. Is that enough? Is there a certain criteria as far as a job, regeneration on these sites?
No, there's not. And in fact, not all sites will create jobs. You can return sites to reuse as green space, parks and recreation fields and things like that that aren't job creators. So there's not a maximum.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions by phone? Okay. We've got 3 more right now, and we've got about 6 minutes to deal with them. So the next question is, our resource conservation and development councils considered eligible entities
Our council has 501c3 nonprofit status. If you're a nonprofit, you're actually not eligible for assessment grants. Nonprofits are eligible for cleanup grants, which we'll be talking about in the next session. If you're some other kind of organization created by the state legislature or the county government, we have been looking at the articles of creation for these different organizations and getting legal determinations, and we'll have to do that on an entity specific basis here. The next question is, I went to this link, and this is the Clue-In link, and noticed the Success Tips tool is listed as under construction. You referenced this tool many times. When will it be made available?
I sent it up to the Clue-In this morning. They said it would be posted, so it'd be real soon. I'll go ahead and call Peter up there as soon as I get off this call. I was expecting it to be already uploaded. So please be patient.
And we can also ensure that we email those to you all as well. We have your email addresses, so we'll make sure that you receive those.
And the last question that we've got up there right now is, if there is a coalition applying, which includes the city, what advice would you give about the individual city applying on their own or with the coalition? Well, as we probably mentioned, if you apply as a coalition, you're not able to apply on your own. So you've got to make a decision as to what the pros and cons are of doing it. I think one thing that the coalitions offer, particularly for new grantees, smaller towns where, you know, you've got somebody that's wearing 12 different hats, the coalition is a good thing if your lead coalition partner is experienced. You can get involved in the Brownfields program. You can benefit from it, but have somebody else deal with the administrative tasks of dealing with the grant. So I think that's one big consideration that I would use in trying to decide which way to go. You know, you might look at the coalition and have some discussions about how much of a share of the funds you're going to get. There are a variety of other factors. I think the administrative issues are probably the biggest thing, particularly for small cities and towns. And we've just got another one, and we've got a couple of minutes left. With regard to community-wide assessment grants, the EPA will review sites individually for eligibility for hazardous substances, the State Environmental Authority for Petroleum. Can you elaborate on the procedures? The grant lasts 3 years, and there seems to be a good deal of flexibility for the community to drive the site selection process in such a way that a site could be proposed in year one, another set of sites in year two, et cetera. The EPA says site selection can be an ongoing process. And petroleum sites are deemed eligible by the state. How does the grantee go about funding petroleum assessments? With the community-wide grant, the sites are identified along the way throughout the course of the grant. You could have a set of sites as you described in year one, another set of sites in year two. You can have them any time along the way, and we'll evaluate those sites for eligibility. For phase twos, we actually, it's a good point. We don't evaluate generally eligibility on phase one. It's a streamlined evaluation that we give you a small tool to do yourself. The community-wise are very flexible for going through that identification process and going along with the pace of whatever activities occur within your community that you're involved with to help identify sites. And it says that I know that petroleum assessments would be a minimum of 25% of funded projects. Is there a maximum? I believe it's just a minimum that we have to meet. I don't think it's necessarily capped, but again, I don't know the answer to that for sure. We'll have to check on that just to be sure about it. Just a little bit more time here. Based on the national funding levels for the 2009 year, how many coalition grants do you anticipate funding? And that's something that we don't know at this point in time. It's so new. We're going to learn a lot from this process, and we're going to see, if this is a valuable approach to awarding assessment grants. And apparently the success tips tool is now working. So, with that, our time is pretty much up for the assessment call. We're going to reconvene in 5 minutes to start the cleanup call. So if y'all all want to take a brief break, those of you who want to come back on to talk about cleanups, this is Mike Norman, Brownfield Coordinator for EPA Region 4. We're ready to begin the session on cleanups and revolving loan funds. I want to welcome everybody to this session, particularly those who have just joined us. We did conduct a session earlier on assessment grant opportunities. And basically, I'm going to start out by going through an introductory slide presentation on the grant opportunities that are available on the Brownfields program and whatnot. I'm going to start out by just introducing our speakers, our presenters for this session. I'll be starting out. Brian Holtzclaw and Margaret Crow, who are both project officers here overseeing and managing Brownfields grants, are also going to be presenters here. Just to back up and cover some house rules in particular for those of you who just joined us, we plan on going through our slideshow here and answering questions at the end. If you are online, you can pose a question online. We will take questions from the audience for those of you who are participating by phone. We'll also try to keep emphasizing the slide number for those of you who are keeping up on your computer and not on the simulcast. We do have people on the simulcast and people on the phone so that we can keep you on the proper slide. And if you do have any simulcast problems, you can dial 301-589-5318 to see about getting those problems corrected. So with that, we'll jump to slide number 3, where we'll cover what we're talking about here today. As I mentioned, I'll give a Brownfields overview, talk about the grant types and amounts, and specifically, I'd like to make one interruption. On this second training, the Clewin program married our two presentations together. So there's going to be, we're going to have to, for those on the simulcast, we're going to have to say that it starts on, Mike's going to start talking on page 81, which is technically our page 3. So we'll probably have to interchange that to everybody be on the same page.
Okay, thanks, Brian.
So, again, those on the simulcast should be on slide number 81, and those who are reviewing at home are on slide 3. And so I'm going to talk about an overview of the program, talk about the grant types and amounts, and specifically for this session we'll be talking about cleanup and revolving loan fund grants. We're going to cover the threshold criteria that you'll have to meet and demonstrate in applying for these grants. We'll talk about the ranking criteria as well. There have been many changes this year since last year in the whole approach and in the scoring system. And we'll provide you with some tips on how to put together strong presentations.
next slide is heading for the Brownfields overview. And then the following slide, labeled Brownfields Mission. Our program is basically a cleanup and assessment program. We deal with the kinds of sites that, in turning them around and in dealing with their contamination problems and eliminating blight, we see that it promotes economic redevelopment, green space creation in communities. And so we provide financial assistance through grants to do that. We also provide technical assistance in assessment and cleanup. We also provide job training grants through a separate competition. That competition is ongoing now and closes on October 14th. On the next slide, you'll see the Brownfields definition. And I'm just going to read that definition from the statute. It's real property, the expansion, redevelopment, or reuse of which may be complicated by the presence or potential presence of hazardous substances, pollutants, contaminants, controlled substances, petroleum or petroleum products, or is mine-scarred land. And one of the important aspects of that definition is the notation of the potential presence of hazardous substances, because often it's the perception that there is contamination, and with that contamination are extensive liabilities, environmental liabilities, financial liabilities to address that contamination, and that alone is often keeping properties that have good locations from being redeveloped. We find that about 30% of the properties that we assess do not require cleanup. So perception is a big problem that may not be a real problem in some cases. On the next slide, you see some of the types of substances that we can address. Hazardous substances is a regulatory term. Under Superfund, there is a list of hazardous substances, a very extensive list of hazardous substances. Petroleum contamination can include a variety of substances from crude oil to refined products such as gasoline and diesel fuel. Asbestos and lead paint are hazardous substances. They're eligible to be addressed under these grants. Controlled substances is specifically mentioned in the definition. So such things as methamphetamine labs can be addressed with our grant funds. Mine-scarred lands can be addressed as well, including the tailings from mines and where those tailings have come to be located. And a variety of other environmental contaminants fit under the pollutant or contaminant portion of that definition. On the next slide, which is number 86 on the simulcast and number 8 on those viewing at home, our mission throughout EPA, throughout all of our media programs, is protection of human health and the environment. And it's no different with Brownfields. In the Brownfields program, though, in conducting and carrying out that mission, we see a lot of additional benefits to you and communities throughout America, in particular, in this case, the Southeast. By redeveloping these properties, you're able to increase the local tax base. You're able to create jobs. You're able to use the existing infrastructure. And I brought up a point on the previous session that I've heard the evidence that for every acre of brownfields that's redeveloped, it prevents 4 acres of green space from being destroyed. So you're able to bring that real estate back into productive reuse and prevent sprawl into suburbia. Less commute times mean cleaner air. You're able to reduce environmental and human health risk in those communities where these sites are located. And so you see an overall improvement in quality of life and preservation of cultural values. Moving on to the next slide. This is the Brownfields program is a continuum, basically. We see communities that we work with start out with a vision, start out with just an idea, getting their community together at the grassroots level, perhaps identifying sites
prioritizing sites and then assessing them to see if there is contamination that needs to be addressed. Finding the funding resources. These grants are among those funding resources that are available. And then cleaning up and redeveloping those sites. And a variety of benefits does result from that. In fact, I'll talk about them on the next slide, which is number 88 on the simulcast and 10 on the if you're viewing at home. Our program started in the 1994-1995 time frame as a pilot program, and the law passed in 2002. Since that time, since our beginning, we've awarded nearly 2,000 brownfields grants for a total of almost $600 million. But that's had a multiplying effect in terms of the effectiveness. We've assessed almost 12,000 properties. From the $600 million that we've granted, we've leveraged more than $11 billion in cleanup and redevelopment funding from public and private sources, and we've generated nearly 50,000 jobs. A lot of benefits from this program. And you see on the next slide an example of one of our grantees' success stories. They took an urban creek that was very contaminated, and they've restored it through the use of these grants and a lot of active public participation. And in 2007, they won a Phoenix Award, which is perhaps the biggest award given for redevelopment of contaminated properties. Going on to the next slide, you see a breakdown of the Brownfields program, and it's basically a two-part program. The law authorizes up to $200 million for these types of grants, the assessment revolving loan fund and cleanup grants, the job training grants, and for targeted brownfields assessment. 25% of that funding has to be given out to address petroleum. In reality, we've been appropriated around $90 million a year for the most part. The proposal guidelines discuss us granting in this competition, I believe $81.3 million is what we propose to give out. So a big chunk of that funding is given out in the form of grants. The other part of the program is a $50 million program for states and tribes, for the states and tribes to run their state and tribal response programs. And that's an important component that dovetails into these assessment revolving loan fund and cleanup grants, because the work that you do under these grants is done under the eyes of the states that we're funding a portion of their program operating costs for. You would clean up sites to meet state standards. You would have the state reviewing your work plans and working with you. But we're there every step of the way as well, providing technical assistance to you to work through the process. Moving on to the next slide, these grants collectively under this competition are the Assessment Revolving Loan Fund and Cleanup Grants. We often call them the ARC grant. And so if we use that acronym in this presentation, you'll understand what we're talking about here. The next slide indicates that this is a very competitive program. In fact, about one in three who apply for these grants will be selected to receive the funds. So the need for these funds, the demand for these funds is far greater than the available funding, available resources. So it's important to work hard to engage your community, to establish a vision, to demonstrate a clear need, and tell that story in such a way that it resonates with the reviewers and results in a winning proposal. On the next slide, which is number 93 and 15, last year's competition, we received 845 proposals. 314 of them were selected, and we gave out $74 million in funding.
Roughly two-thirds of those were given out for assessment grants, another third for cleanup grants, and a small handful for revolving loan fund grants. In our region, we received 104 proposals, with 50 of them selected for funding that's $11.4 million. And we're particularly proud of the fact that 48% of those who applied from our region were successful, far above the national average. So our time frame for this competition period is that the guidelines were made available on August 22nd of this year. These proposals, as you all may know, are due on November 14th, must be postmarked by November 14th. In the mid-April to perhaps mid-May time frame of next year, we expect to be making an announcement of who's been selected to receive these funds. And in our region, our plans are to engage those of you who are selected immediately to start developing work plans and submit your grant paperwork. We're going to try to award these grants as we try to this year by June 30th, so that the funds will be available to you on July 1st. That's our plan and our hope. On the next slide, number 17 and 95, you see the web addresses for the various proposal guidelines. In years past, there was one set of guidelines that covered each one of these, that covered every one of these assessment revolving loan fund and cleanup grants. This year, they're broken out separately. Hopefully, that'll avoid some confusion as to what is required for cleanup versus what is required for assessment and whatnot. We're going to try to clear up some of that here today, and again, you're welcome to ask questions to help clear up anything like that, either on the call today or later on. My contact information is in these guidelines, and so my number is published there, and you can feel free to call me and ask questions to clarify some of the requirements. We aim to give you a lot of good training and good tips on the program, on what you need to submit to put together a winning proposal. But there's a lot of detail provided in these guidelines, and I encourage you very strongly to read them thoroughly and understand the guidelines when you put together the proposals. There are checklists in there that are very helpful to make sure that nothing is left out. And again, feel free to ask questions if you have any about the need to clarify any of the provisions in there. And with that, I am going to turn it over to Margaret Crowe to talk about the Revolving Loan Fund Grant Program.
Hi, my name is Margaret Crowe, and I work with several grants, including the Revolving Loan Fund. The Revolving Loan Fund is a enhanced cleanup grant with a financial side. The financial side is made up of loans and sub-grants. The strength of the Revolving Loan Fund is that you're able to work with a site owner or a developer or someone who has the property to give them a loan to do the cleanup. Now, you may use these fees from once you give a loan, once you give someone a loan, they're the borrower, and so you'll be paying. You could provide low-interest loans or no-interest loans, and this interest is program income to help meet your cost share. Now, on Revolving Loan Fund, there's a 20% cost share, and you can pass that on to the borrower. So the slide talks about the EPA is giving you the cooperative agreement to an eligible entity, and then you can pass that, you can make a loan to a site owner or developer, and that would be the borrower or a subgrantee. The loans, you can have apply for up to $1 million per eligible entity, which is a government kind of, it's defined in the guidelines. nonprofits are not eligible to apply for these. These are five-year grants. You have to give out 60% of your funds for loans, and that would be your output. And when you come into the grant, you want to explain that you want to get maybe two loans jurisdiction-wide in a community-wide program. And you could give, you have to give at least 60%. And then you have to give them, you can give sub-grants, and those can be 40% of your cleanup costs. Now, on the next slide, it talks about Palm Beach, Florida. This was the first successful loan that Region 4 made. It was the South Florida Planning Council loaned $800,000 to a private developer, and they, for a 13-acre affordable housing unit on Malibu Bay, and they did a golf course as well. So the revolving loan fund is one of those grants that it, you need to show your program capabilities in order to deal with it, and we'll go through that as we go. So when you put in your grant, how many loans, how many sub-grants you're going to make, that would be your output, and then your outcomes would be you cleaned up the site, and then you have program income to use back in your community. And Brian Holtzclaw is going to address slide 20, which is slide 98.
All right, fantastic. Hello, everyone. Here to talk about the cleanup grant program. Typically, we've had from, I think, as high as close to 30 grants come in on cleanup grants, and we really look forward to those out there making a proposal about getting a cleanup grant. The purpose is to conduct cleanup activities at brownfield sites. For beginners, they are up to $200,000 per property. It can deal with hazardous substances or petroleum contamination. You may apply up to three properties. Last year, I forgot the name of the city, but they had a great grant writer, and they got actually three cleanup grants for that municipality on separate properties. The applicant applying for both hazardous substance and petroleum cleanup grant funding at the same time must submit one proposal. And again, you cannot exceed the $200,000 limit. Compared to all our other kinds of grants, nonprofits, I underscore nonprofits, can apply for cleanup grants. The cost share requirement is 20%. That is much different than the assessment grants, which is cost share free. It is 20%, and we'll get into ideas later how you can represent that to us in the grant and also during your conducting the grant. One of the new criteria is that you must have community notification. It is a threshold pass-fail criteria component, and I'm going to tell you a little bit more about that. It's relatively easy to accomplish via an ad. You must have a fee simple title by June 30th, 2009. If you do not think you as the applicant can indeed own that as a single owner by that date, do not bother to apply. We unfortunately had several fantastic grant writers got selected in the spring, but could not cut the deal by June 30th, and we had to take the money. We never gave them the money, but we had to cancel the potential grant. So if you already own a property, that's really fantastic. If you're working to obtain it, that's good, too. We will want a little verbiage on that within the grant. And, again, this is a three-year grant period. As opposed to Margaret's five-year grant RLS.
The next slide is slide 21 or slide 99. The success story on the east side of Atlanta here, there was a applicant who represented the Atlantic Youth Soccer Association. Prior to them getting a cleanup grant, there was a lot of waste. I think it was a mixture of hazardous and petroleum waste on this particular property. It was an industrial-based property. They took our grant and leveraged it with some other, I think, foundation dollars, and it was much more than our $200,000 grant, and successfully cleaned it up, and now youth are enjoying a soccer field as a result. The other cleanup, EPA Brownfields programs, which you can elect to take part in, are the Brownfields Job Training Grant Program. Unfortunately, that deadline is about 12 days away. I think it's October 14th, but it comes around once a year, and you can get more information on it at that website. The other thing is a Targeted Brownfields Assessment Program. That's an application-based program. As the previous slide indicated, that is funded on a national level. You can apply for those assessments to be conducted either by EPA Region 4 directly or sometimes through your state program. Slide starts one of the major sections, and that's threshold. There is some pictures of some cleanups we've worked on, particularly in Miami and Spartanburg, South Carolina. Threshold criteria, it is a must-pass criteria. As opposed to ranking where we score and you get points for certain how well you write a section, this is just a pass-fail. Just give us the information we're looking for, and we'd love to pass you. Put as much information as you can, but keep in mind you have and we haven't got to this, 18 pages total. So be as brief to the point, but adequately respond to their criteria, or else you'll cut into your pages that you need to dedicate it to truly get the points, and that's the ranking criteria area. So you need to be concise. They have been developed mainly to make sure we follow Congress's intent of this law, and we give this money out to eligible recipients. In the guidelines, it lists who those are, and I think we've already identified that. Mostly local government authorities go after these grants. And we want success, of course. So the applicant responses, we do the regional review here in Atlanta for all the proposals that come in, and you must pass all the criteria. In the threshold criteria, and we're going to make this as easy as possible. I'm going to represent the cleanup voice, okay? And Margaret is going to represent the RLF voice. There are certain things that apply to RLF grants that you absolutely need in your criteria, and some that only apply to cleanup grants, and some that apply to both. We're going to do our darn best on making this as simple as possible. On slide 20, I can't read it. 103 or 25 lists the menu of all of the threshold criteria that we look for. The first one, applicant eligibility. Both kinds of grantees need to do, same with the other one, the basic letter from the state, in most cases state authority. As far as the cleanup grants, eligibility, and we have plenty of slides to cover on that. I think about one slide to talk about cost share.
one short slide about legal authority, and that's RLF. Another RLF is description of jurisdiction. We'll also, for both of us, me and Margaret, and the RLF and cleanup, we'll talk about cleanup authority and also notification. One thing, the next slide, pertains to both of us is applicant eligibility. Eligible entities are the general purpose of local government. State size, quasi-governmental entities. Often we get regional planning councils and things like that. And also nonprofits, but that is only cleanup grants. Another thing that applies, Margie, you want to talk about this coalition?
In order to apply for an RLF, you have to be an eligible entity, and it's the local government. The RLF must be jurisdiction-wide, so they're community-wide. If you're a city, it's going to be the city boundaries. If you're a regional council of government, it's going to be the counties you work in. So one of the coalition for the coalition applications, you must have two or more coalition members. Each one must be an eligible entity, and you must include that in the proposal on how each member is eligible.
All right. Next slide, again, mine is the voice of cleanup, so you must have site ownership June 30th. Typically, as Mike said, we'll notify you if you pass the test, meaning get a certain number grade on the ranking. It will notify you that you've been selected. We encourage you to not go after this if you don't think you can ever own the property, but if you can work toward owning that property or already have it in hand, single ownership, that's great. But that is an absolute. You must have fee simple title. The other thing that applies to both me and Margaret and cleanup and RLF is this letter from state or tribal authorities. It must be a current letter. You can't recycle an old one. And it must just have them acknowledge that they know that you're planning to go after a cleanup or RLF grant. It's a very simple letter. Some of the states have more verbiage, and they want to know more. Some of them also prefer to look at your draft proposal. Some of them don't. So it depends on the state you're working with. At the very end of this presentation is the state contact information. If you're going after multiple kinds of grants, like an assessment, just make sure that letter, you know, talks about you going after also a cleanup and RLF. And do not wait till the last day, please. We don't want to overburden them. We've got about six weeks left to the deadline, November 14th. So you have plenty of time, and let's give them some room to write that letter for you. All right. The next nine slides are going to pertain to cleanup applicants only. But for those RLFers on the phone, don't necessarily fall asleep, because this eligibility discussion is going to pertain to you when you're at the crossroads of actually conducting some cleanup work. Because before you do a phase two, well, not a phase two, but before you do a cleanup, EPA is going to have to do a little checklist on your site-specific properties. So, on that slide, which we have 108, if I can read this small writing, I think 30, it does prohibit EPA, rather, from providing grant funds to an entity that is considered liable under the Superfund law, and basically Congress didn't want the polluter to pay. So we want, Congress did want the polluter to pay. So if you did contribute to the site pollution, such as a city, you ran an incinerator in the 50s, and you want a cleanup grant to clean up your the mess that you are a responsible party for, you're going to have some problems passing the pass-fail threshold. Superfund does have very broad liability provisions, and the how and when is the big question. I would encourage anyone who's non-technical right now on the phone representing your city that you contact a more technical person on board in your agency or perhaps an environmental consultant that you've been working with, and they can really help you get to this section. The details on cleanup eligibility are on pages 37 to 48, and these slides only touch on the highlights. I don't want to scare you away, but they are very detailed. The next slide, sites that are not eligible, are ones that are on the Superfund National Priorities List, property subject to administrative orders, court orders, and the like. It's all self-explanatory there, and also any property owned by the U.S. government. The next slide makes a distinction between those cleanup sites that are hazardous substance sites. We are the decision maker deciding whether you're potentially liable. And when it comes to petroleum sites, we say that the state is a decision maker as far as liability and so forth. We do, by the way, want you to submit a petroleum eligibility letter, and it is different indeed from the state acknowledgement letter. They will take a look, for instance, if it's an underground storage tank, they'll look at their underground storage tank database and see the degree of risk and so forth, and confirm whether that's already on a pipeline to be already cleaned up using state funds or not. So they have to go through their processes to determine whether the petroleum site is eligible. The next slide, ownership eligibility. We say that the owner is liable unless an exemption applies, and we sure hope that you fall into an exemption. These are the following exemptions or defenses. An involuntary acquisition, and we'll get into that on the next slide. A bona fide prospective purchaser, an innocent landowner, and contiguous property owner. If it applies, your site is indeed eligible. So now I'm on slide 34, 112. The ownership eligibility, the simple thing is this. Call us if you have any questions. Save our time on this call and save your own time by, you know, bang your head against the wall, reading all these guidelines. If you have questions, give us a call. We have phone numbers at the back of this presentation and on the website. There are some common acquisition scenarios, and that's all pretty much self-explanatory. It might be worth on the next slide talking to you about a bona fide prospective purchaser. What that means to us is that you bought the property, you weren't responsible for the historical contamination. Your company is not affiliated with the responsible party who generated the contamination, and that you have conducted adequate, appropriate inquiry on the site. And that's the technical standard for those non-technical people. It's an ASTM standard. You can learn more about that on the Internet. That's what the Internet's good for. But it has to have passed a Phase 1 environmental site assessment. And there's more information on all appropriate inquiry and that standard. What a standard applies is all dependent on when the site was acquired. And that next slide gives you some abbreviated information on that respect. Another cleanup slide, which is 37 or 115, it does require, in fact, a Phase 1 site assessment report is complete, and absolutely, this is a new requirement a Phase 2 site assessment report, which is compliant with the latest ASTM standard in how that is conducted, must have been completed thus far. Hopefully it'll be extremely thorough to increase the feasibility of success of your cleanup project. Another cleanup slide talking about petroleum sites. Site applicants must provide answers to the threshold questions, and those, again, are in the guidelines. We want you to follow through with this. And again, the state is going to go through their pipeline and see if that site is in their pipeline and if indeed it's relatively low risk, and those other three bullets there. The next two slides concern a common threshold with the cleanup and RLF. And Margaret, do you want to touch on that?
For the RLF, you have to have a letter that says you can do the cleanup oversight, and you can have one letter from your attorney or your counsel, but you have to identify it real clearly at the top that you have the legal authority to access and secure the site. And the second thing, you want to make sure that you have the legal authority to manage your RLF, hold funds, make loans, and enter into loan agreements and collect repayments. Now, you can do a coalition. You can be a coalition applicant, and you must have the broadest jurisdiction, and in order to ensure the capability to access sites and secure sites in an area that you say that you're going to do it. Now, the property access plan is for the cleanup only.
Yes.
So,
you must have an access plan because, you know, the worst-case scenario, you spend 80 hours writing this grant proposal or less, and we spend all these hours selecting you for a grant and giving you the money, and then you can't gain access. So we really want upfront a description how you plan to obtain access. The legal opinion, Margaret, we spoke about that yesterday.
The legal opinion, it says it can be one letter, but make sure it's real clear at the top that you're addressing both the authority to access the site and secure the site, and that you have the authority to manage a revolving loan fund. One other person in the groups thought it should be two letters that really clearly address each one. So make sure you label at the top. In terms of the cost share, for the RLF, you're going to have a situation in the RLF where you can pass the cost share on to your borrower. They could, if you give them a loan for $100,000, maybe they need to match it with $20,000. But, in your proposal for the RLF, it's a jurisdiction-wide, it's a community-wide grant, and the grant will, in there you want to explain to us how you're going to meet the cost share, if you are going to pass it on to the borrower.
So if you're going after $1 million, we want you to say that you're going to kick in $200,000.
Right.
And in my case, $200,000 means you are going to kick in $40,000, whether that be in-kind or from local businesses, or whatever. We just want a basic plan outline.
Yeah. The other thing,
you can exceed it though if you're creative, and that's okay with us. But all we care about is you meeting the basic 20%. Another thing here on the slide: no federal funds, can't use other federal grants. Hardship waivers can be requested. We haven't passed any in my recent memory, or distant memory, actually. So try to work creatively on getting creative in-kind resources to make that match work.
Yes, and make sure it's programmatic. Go through that. And
the last three slides, I got the last two, Margaret. So it's community notification. It is on page 19. This is brand new. All we say is we want you to notify the community you're going after this grant by preferably placing an ad. Now, we say parentheses or equivalent at least 2 weeks prior to October 31st. We need you to announce that the proposal is somewhere, whether that be in a library or in your office that the community can comment on, that you will accept comments, and that you have at least one public meeting prior to November 14th. So go ahead and check page 19 out. That is a new requirement. It's fairly simple. It's not much effort, but it is a pass-fail requirement. So we're about ready to wrap up criteria threshold and get on to the real nitty-gritty of the points. Margaret?
Well, I don't know if you can see the slides, but we're having a little difficulty here, and we can't see them right this minute, but the slide that I'm addressing is description of the jurisdiction. The RLFs are community-wide. If your city, it's the city limits. If you're a council of governments, it's the counties that you have been, where you have jurisdiction over. Now, the other thing with RLFs, when you come in, you'll come in for hazardous substance monies, and you also may indicate that you want 750,000 hazardous substance funds, and then, you know, 250,000 for a total of a million. So as you do your budget, you're going to address your petroleum share and your hazardous substance. Now, the hazardous substance can be mixed with petroleum, and as you go through that, you'll indicate where what your mix is going to be in terms of funds. Now we're ready to address the ranking criteria. We still can't see the slides on our end, so we can't change them.
So we're going to pretty much, we're kind of restricted until we get this fixed to just tell you the traditional slide number, and it is slide 44, which is says overview of ranking criteria. So I'll kick off this section. This is the key section where you gain points. The more points you get, closer to 100, the more competitive you are on a national level. At some point where the 800, 900, 1,000 proposals come in, there's going to be a cutoff point. And anyone underneath a certain cutoff point isn't going to get funded. And sometimes it makes a difference of even just a point or two, so we want you to really concentrate on doing your best in each. My slide 45 says ranking criteria. There are four sections this year. Do not use any previous year's proposals and just, turn it in. This is totally revised. Number one, community need. Two, project description. Three, community engagement. And four, project benefits. The next slide is my 46. There are four criteria, but there are 12 actually sub-criteria. They vary from 5 points to, I believe it's up to 20 points. So just looking, even Margaret's, the RLF guidelines are different than the cleanup guidelines, and the points are weighted differently. So just paying attention to how they are. The ranking is found in the guidelines on cleanup, page 26 to 31, and RLF, there's only a few pages, 17 to 23. So we really want you to read those out thoroughly. So, community need, that's the first one. We want you to start off on a really great foot. It's really critical to make a strong first impression by stating your unique case that your community really needs a brownfields grant, both from a health, welfare, environmental, and financial standpoint. So you need to make a persuasive, convincing argument right offhand in this very first section that three reviewers and evaluators are going to read and grade your proposal. The health, welfare, environment, you need to really target your, identify your targeted community. Whether that's a subsector of your city, an entire county, a three-county area. Please describe the target community that you're selecting. I would suggest that you select that based upon the need. As far as brownfields go, we want to hear about your effect on the target community, the number, the size, and the location, and the typical contamination. With respect to this, during these four, this is a short timeout, we are going to be referring to an item, if you weren't on the first talk, on the Kluwen site called the Success Tips Tool. It can be downloaded, and I'm going to refer to a couple tips to give ideas that we've acquired over the last 4 years. We used to incorporate and make this presentation really long. Now it's only a Word document. But, for example, a tip that we do mention on the Success Tips Tool on page 2 and 3 speak to, if you don't know what those brownfields are, go ahead and do a drive. I'm not going to say drive-by. What is it, folks in the room here? Help me out.
Peruse.
A peruse, she says. Okay, a driving survey. Scouting mission. Take a look. And look in some old city directories. Perhaps do some research. Contact your state brownfields coordinator. Maybe they have a list of former manufacturing sites, or even a database on abandoned USPs. Go ahead and that's one tip that we include. Another one is we do give some ideas on types of contamination at typical brownfield sites. And another tip is talking about, yes, a resource in the U.S. Census Bureau. We have her name, phone number, email, and she's a great resource. Following on the other two elements, and we do have more tips on this, but I'm going to keep it brief here. You need to talk about sensitive populations, elderly, minorities, children, women of childbearing ages, and also if you have any disproportionate environmental impact data, we want to definitely, you know, see if you have that established on a local, regional, or state level that targets the kind of community you're targeting. The second part in here, which is 50% of community need, is financial need. We want you to talk about the rates of poverty, household income. It says the rest. We really encourage you to use a tabular format. We do have an example on the next slide. It is important to make it easy for us to take in all this information. We've seen people just write paragraphs and paragraphs of data, and it does put evaluators to sleep. So be concise, put it in the table. Talk about perhaps recently closed factory, if there was a GE plant, how many jobs were lost, and other reasons why financial resources may not be available. So I'm going to pass the hat on off to Margaret, and we are at slide 50. Bill, you can put my name in there. And we'll move on to project description.
The time is 3:57. We're still having trouble getting the slides back up. I don't know what you see, but we don't see anything. Does this continue?
They're at their own pace. They're at their own pace on the simulcast and the phone line reservationists that probably downloaded the presentation. The only thing we can do is tell you the long slide number. We have the short slide number.
Well, my slide is about project description of feasibility of success. Under the RLF, that's a whopping 45 points. And the community need was 15 points. And the program description, where you're going to describe your project activities, you want to list how many loans you may give. You want to say jurisdiction-wide, but you want to say maybe in a reinvestment quarter or in the mill area or down by the river or the river corridor or a highway corridor that you're going to concentrate getting
borrowers to, you're going to market those areas hard. You want to describe your project activities as loans. You want to say how many loans, how many subgrants. You want to illustrate your plan is very reasonable. Let's say that you were able to give a subgrant to a community college who is going to, one project I've seen is a community college that was working on a green space by the river. So you want to demonstrate that you have the capacity and resources and the capability to complete the project in a appropriate time. Now, if you don't have a fund manager, you may hire someone to do that, as well as a qualified environmental consultant. So you want to convince the people who are reading it that you have the capability to select and hire help. So it doesn't say that you have to have it on board, but that you want to as a grantee, you will make sure that you have a competitive procurement and an appropriate way to kind of address the sites for cleanup. Then on slide 51, you want to address how your redevelopment program and how your RLF funding will be able to provide support to your community and meet your community needs. In terms of a sustainable plan, you want to assure the person who's reading it that you're going to build program capacity to deal with brownfield issues. One of the things that you might indicate is that future program income, when you pay back the RLF loan, will be rolled back into brownfields, that you may use that program income and the repayment of loans to bridge a cleanup funding gap. And you want to address how you're going to find borrowers and subgrantees. You want to indicate that you're going to get your team together early of a fund manager, a contractor for your qualified environmental professional who's going to direct the cleanup activities to protect human health. And then you want to explain how that you know who you're going to market this to. Explain your client base, the developers in your areas. And, you know, it's a changing market right now. So you want to identify sources of capital and the type of assistance you're going to be offered, what kind of loans you're going to offer. You want to market it to potential customers and sites. You want to indicate that you're going to have flexible sources of financing, the loan structures, and you want to convey to the reader that you know what you need to do in order to address the marketing plan.
Margaret, before you move on, you know, she's the voice of RLF, I'm the voice of cleanups, and I did want to make sure that this is where you get your first impression talking to these readers, these three evaluators, on what you plan to do in the cleanup. It's really instrumental to cover the basics on your cleanup plan that has been derived from your phase one, your institutional or engineering controls that are before you, and also any ideas on site reuse plans. A lot of times those ideas can be formulated from any kind of master plan or visioning processes beforehand. And also on that slide 50, I do recommend you look at the programmatic requirements in the guidelines. They really give you an idea of a slice of what we expect as far as our terms and conditions of the grants, and it speaks well to the things that we're looking for you to accomplish under both RLF and cleanup. And that's on starts on page 25 for the RLF and page 33 for cleanup. Thanks, Margaret.
There are some sample formatted budgets, and as you look at it for the RLF, there's two of them. There's one for project tasks for loans, which has to be at least 60%. You may have hazardous and petroleum funds in there, and what you want to do is you want to use your budget to describe the task, but while you're describing the task, you want to talk about how you know kind of where you're going community-wide, that you're going to remove or mitigate or prevent a release of a hazardous substance. You want to show how you're going to do eligible uses of the funds, but you're also going to address, so your task, a task might be marketing and outreach, or a task might be fund management. A task might be cleanups. And then you, under each one of those, you would have to address the hazardous substance amount, so that you would want to let us know how much was petroleum and how much was hazardous for each task. There is a cost share. Now, in the RLS, you can pass that cost share on to the borrower. So that is a 20% cost share, but you want to show us how you're going to meet that. In terms of the subgrants, you can't put in any more than 40%. And again, your task might be outreach, marketing, fund administration, and cleanup. And you want to, again, address your hazardous funds or petroleum funds, and it's community-wide. Now,
I do have a budget sheet in the presentation dedicated to cleanup, and I really encourage you to look at the sample format for the budget for the cleanup grant. Another thing, we do put some really valuable tips on how to speak to the tasks that you identified in the budget table, and please refer to the success tips tool.
The next slide, 56, addresses leveraging, and you might indicate in your proposal where you've had public funds that you are going to use from the city, and you're going to indicate how you're going to complete a cleanup using maybe private funds. Maybe there's an area you want to develop that, and you want to seek to complete the work, but there may not be enough funds. So describe other sources of funding and other successes you've had and other partners you've worked with, and also indicate successful revitalization projects that have been cleaned up, you know, with your indicating that you have leveraged other funds. Now we're on
programmatic
capabilities. All applicants, it says, must demonstrate their ability to manage a grant and oversee the work. The RLS was tough, and so if you've had an EPA grant in the past, you want to talk about your capacity and how you successfully manage the grants, how you have, achieved cleanups, that you have properties that you know of that are really ready to go, that your fund expenditures and your balance of your grant was drawn down and you were successful. You want to talk about your compliance with grant requirements, the work plan, the schedule, meeting, you know, getting your financial status reports, and you want to explain how you were successful with using EPA's funds either to assess, clean up, or redevelop brownfield sites. The slide 58 indicates that you're going to get your team together early for programmatic capabilities. Let's say you haven't had an EPA brownfields grant. You want to describe how you can either hire the expertise, how you know how to identify problems, and what grant management you have done, and plan for your management and performance. You can either use in-house or, hire their expertise, and talk about your three past years of grant management, indicate specifically who was for, and any adverse audit findings. The overview of...
That's nine.
That's yours?
Okay.
You go.
All right. Criteria three. the general view is that they want you to know how you're going to engage with the community, your partnerships, and also we want to hear about the commitments from community-based organizations. Slide 60 or 138, community engagement. We want a plan for community involvement. Talk about that site selection. We have some good ideas on how you might go about working with the community on that, how you're going to involve the community in cleanup planning, reuse, how you're going to report of the progress of the community. Next slide, partnerships. We definitely want you to project how you're going to interact with both local environmental and health agencies. If you don't know who those entities are, get to know them right now, because we want them identified by name and agency. How are you going to work together? We want you to start researching what the state program looks like. Want to know how you're going to interact with them. When it comes to a cleanup, you're going to have to, you know, work with them on state cleanup standards, remedial action plans, and site completions. So go ahead and do your homework and relay it to us there. The third slide under this criteria is community-based organizations. Community-based to us means mostly grassroots, closer to the ground, the faith-based, the neighborhood groups, those kind of organizations. We don't want to hear about how a non-key partner such as a political representative is a CBO. It's just not. So we want you to describe those organizations, supply support letters. It's all in the guidelines as well as the success tips on how you might really get some good grades on that section. In the success tips, we even give examples of sample roles your partners may have in your efforts. We also have ideas on when you might want to be telling us about how you're going to schedule meetings to be conducive to residents who may work at day or night, or how you may want to piggyback meetings onto meetings. So for the sake of time, I'm going to move on to project benefits and hand that back to Margaret.
In terms of project benefits, your strategy for RLS should look at your loan features, your program parameters, and services that you can meet your community needs. You want to describe how sub-grants will help facilitate green space or meet the community needs. And once you give a sub-grant, you don't get that money back, so you want to make sure that you give 60% of your funds and loans, and you kind of want to explain how your grant promotes the general welfare and how it contributes to your vision, and how the RLF program and repayment of those loans will be used to contribute to your vision for the RLF. For the project benefits on slide 65, you will need to describe how your grant will produce economic benefits. You want to make sure that you convey the public health that will be impacted, but you also want to convey that there are economic benefits, that you have added parks or greenways, or you've taken care of blight. The documentation of the economic activities should include results that happen because of the brownfields properties, and you want to clean up the property so they're ready for reuse, and you want a description how the redevelopment of brownfields properties will contribute to the community-wide redevelopment and revitalization plans, or mixed use, or emphasis on how the funding of the brownfields will make a difference.
I want to say one thing about cleanups, and this actually goes back to the previous slide, welfare and public health. We have some good ideas and success tips, ideas on how you can protect the community during the cleanup, and EPA definitely wants you to tell us how you're going to directly and indirectly protect the public during your cleanup activities.
In terms of project benefits, one of the examples could be clean energy. And if you are able to have renewable sources of energy and water efficiency at a brownfield site, ways that you could conserve water and incorporate high efficiency fixtures, how to promote water conservation, and you want to be able to address green remediation. EPA has just put out a manual on that. Green remediation is the practice of considering all environmental effects of the remedy implementation, and you want to maximize the environmental benefit of the cleanup actions.
Yeah, and again, the Success Tips tool have a lot of examples on being green during your cleanup, after your cleanup, and we didn't want to hear about that.
On slide 67, where it talks about program outcomes, you want to, those are things that happen because you got the grant and that will contribute to the overall vision of the revitalization of brownfield sites. Now, outputs are like how many loans you give, how many sub-grants, but outcomes are more of a how you promote the general welfare through the improvement of public health and safety, economy, and the environment of the targeted community for which the RLF will be community-wide.
Okay, we're down in the home stretch here. I'm on page 146, also page 68. Just some general tips on creating a good proposal. And again we even go beyond this in the Success Tips tool. Basically, we want you to tell us your story that tracks closely with the four criteria. Make sure all the criteria are responded. As far as grant writing tools, we have it at that website. The one that we've been referring to is called the Success Tips tool. It's at least 15 pages. It's in Word. What we envision you is, you know, you typing up your grant proposal and having that as a resource right next to you. It's far better than reading this small print on a PowerPoint. The second tool is our second year that we've designed for participants in this workshop. It's called a section length tool, basic instruction. It's a simple calculator that will guide you in how many pages to perhaps allocate to certain criteria and sub-criteria. As we all know, some criteria is higher weighted and some aren't. And it's a very simple tool. If you have any questions, call us. But we encourage you to use that. In years past, we've seen people write about things that they love to write about, but don't score very high. It's not much point score allocated. The other next page, more preparation, review feedback from previous years, get mentoring. This we can't underscore enough. Go on that website, get prior grantees. Usually they're flattered if you call them. They may share the proposal, but keep in mind it's different this year. Contact your state brownfields office. Perhaps environmental consultants have helped write these kind of grants before, and also the TAB program. There are checklists. On the next slide, within the guidelines that you need to check off as you go through here, and please, please write it as if these people are from California and Maine and Chicago, which they probably will be. Assume they know nothing. So the next slide, formatting, 18-page limit. You have to subtract the threshold pages that you use, and that's what you come up with the narrative. So be precise on those threshold pages. 1-inch margins, everything self-explanatory there. The next page, go ahead and use bolding when you need to, and make sure you don't avoid missing pages. Next page, we're free to contact you to contact us with eligibility questions. Get your state and tribal letters now. And for cleanup, get that public notification, get going as soon as possible. In the resources, there are two phone numbers and names. We've uploaded the entire Brownfields team onto the Cluin site, so you can contact any one of us, and we will be able to help you for the next 6 weeks on mostly threshold criteria. There's all your state Brownfields leads in Region 4, all the states. They're on board, and they've worked closely with us in years past and this year to work together as partners with EPA to work with you as communities to develop brownfields, clean up and assess sites and their resources, particularly for that state acknowledgement letter and petroleum letter. There are websites on the very last page, which I won't get into. They're on the website also, and they're good resources. So without further ado, we're going to start on our questions. We only have a few. If you are a simulcast member, we encourage you to send one forward. And we're going to open also the lines up to phone callers.
Okay, I'll start on the first one. And it looks like it's a carryover from the assessment discussion earlier. It says in the checklist for assessment grants, page 29 of the guidelines, the fourth item is document of applicant eligibility, if other than city, county, state, or tribe. In the cited section, it states for entities other than cities, counties, tribes, or states, please attach documentation of your eligibility, e.g. resolution statutes, et cetera. For regional planning councils, what type of documentation are you expecting? I don't believe we've provided separate documentation for RPCs previously. We have actually been reviewing a lot of that kind of documentation lately from people who are interested in forming coalitions. So it is available. There are statutes where the state legislature created certain organizations. There may be local ordinances where the county government or the city government might have created an organization. And those are the kind of things that you can provide to us to document your eligibility. The next question is, are construction demolition costs covered under a cleanup grant? And let me just break that into two parts and talk about construction and demolition separately. The demolition costs, if you can demolish a structure if you need to get to the contamination. These are cleanup grants. They're not, they're not demolition grants. So if that structure is in the way of accessing contaminated soil or getting to groundwater or some other contaminated media, then it can be removed in order to access that contamination. The second part is, are construction costs covered? Well, certainly not the redevelopment type construction, except in the case where it may be part of the remedy. And there are some examples where you might use a parking lot as a cap over your contaminated soil. And in a case like that, that would be an eligible cost, but not to build the building, to actually do the redevelopment. Again, these are cleanup grants, so they are to be used to develop remedies to address the contamination. The next question is, for a cleanup grant, can the cleanup be completed and the grant is reimbursed for the project? I think I've had some conversations with your consultant on this particular case already. Surprisingly enough, in one region, not ours, this has been done. I think it's a rare case. It involved a pretty high-level decision. There's no guarantee in a situation like that. There's no guarantee that you would apply successful for the grant, but I will just say that it has been done where somebody did do a cleanup prior to receiving the funds, and they were reimbursed for the costs. Okay, are there any questions from the phone? That's all the questions that we've got online.
Could I make a request for those wanting to get off early? Please fill out the feedback form. Thank you.
No other questions? Well, I
thank you all for participating. And again, if you have any additional questions, please feel free to give us a call. I do want to add just one thing. With these guidelines, the revisions to these guidelines, one of the things that we're really emphasizing on cleanup grants in particular is that you, the more prepared you are to do the cleanup, the more site characterization that you've done, the more evaluating of alternatives, selecting an alternative, knowing the cost, understanding that this is a $200,000 grant for cleanup, and that your cost can be handled with your cleanup can be handled with that $200,000, or that you have sought additional sources of funding for cleanup. All of those, the more prepared you are, the more you understand what you're getting into here, is going to come through in your write-up. And those proposals that demonstrate that higher degree of readiness for a cleanup are going to be the ones selected. If you've got a very limited phase two assessment and you really don't know what your cleanup remedy is or how extensive it is, I encourage you to conduct additional assessment before you apply for the cleanup grant. Consider whether or not this is the right year to apply for that cleanup grant. We do get a lot of grantees coming in with a lot of additional assessment needed. They use up a lot of that time that is the three-year period getting assessments and leave a little bit of time at the end for cleanup. And that's really not the way to do that. There's a high demand for these grants. Those who are more ready should be the ones to get the funds first. And so be well prepared and reflect that in your proposal. If there are no additional questions, I thank you, and this call is adjourned.